All right, and to cap off our day today, we have two speakers visiting from Nebraska who are going to talk to us about the benefits of airborne geophysical surveys to water resource managers in Nebraska. And it's going to make you go, wow, I'll tell you. A little bit about our two speakers. Ron Horn is the general manager of the South Platte Natural Resources District, headquartered in Sydney, Nebraska. His responsibilities involve working with a board of directors to conserve, protect, and enhance the natural resources in the South Platte Natural Resources District. Mr. Horn has been with the district for 25 years, and he's the taller of the two gentlemen over there. James Candia is a registered professional geologist in Nebraska and Wyoming and is currently a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Mitchell, Nebraska. He is the team leader for the Nebraska USGS Geophysical Program, focusing on hydrogeologic framework and groundwater surface water studies. He's worked on various geologic, hydrologic, hydrogeologic investigations within Nebraska and Wyoming on surface water, groundwater, water quality, geology, geologic hazards, and geophysics. And I will now turn the floor over to our Nebraska team.
You'll see this microphone go up and down a little bit. Well, Mindy, I've got to compliment you. This is kind of like the box office season for movies. So you've kind of given us a build-up. I hope we don't let you down. But like all, there you go, like all good stories, there's concepts that you can relate to and unique parts of the story that hopefully you'll pick up and find entertaining and valuable. So we're going to do a tag team. This is the unusual part, but what we're going to try to do is lay the groundwork for why Nebraska does what it does, and that's Rod's end of things. And then we're going to talk about the unique science that's coming along to help do groundwater management. With that, I'm going to introduce my good friend and colleague who I've worked with for over 20 years, Rod Horn. And don't blame him when he talks about Gopher football because he's an ex-Husker. So,
thank you, Jim. And Jim sort of took my thunder away. We're looking forward to leaving the Big 8 and entering into the Big 10. And next year we play the Minnesota Gophers on October 22nd, I believe. So we look forward to that period of time. And I think most Nebraskans are looking forward to that, not only for sports, but to academia world as well. I think that's very intriguing as well. I want to thank Mindy and the Association Board for inviting us back here. It's a wonderful state, and I'd like to travel a little bit west, give you a little bit of background of our area. The final product here, the benefits of airborne geophysical survey, is the wow part of this that Jim will talk about. I'll enter into that a little bit, but I want to provide a little bit of background of our local control through natural resources districts. It's a concept that's unique to Nebraska, I believe, and I'd like to cover a little bit of that, a little bit about the tools that we use in managing groundwater and our responsibility in that area. Is it the right click or left? Okay. This is the district that I manage, the South Platte Natural Resources District, located in the southern portion of the Nebraska Panhandle. It consists of all of Kimball, Cheyenne, and Dual County. And we're about one of four districts that actually align with the county. So it makes it a little bit easier to try to manage. We were given our names based on the watershed, surface watershed. Our district, surface water-wise, drains all the way to the South Platte River, which is in the a little bit in the Dole County in the southeast corner here. I'd like to mention that this is characterized by the upland plains area. Many years ago was the Shoregrass Prairie. It's the predominant water course, and this is something to keep in mind here, is the Lodgepole Creek. It starts from northeast part of Laramie, Wyoming, and then drains all the way mostly through our district and then connects with the confluence of the South Platte River in Ovid, Colorado. So we're bordered by Colorado to the south and Wyoming to the west, and there's some limitations there because we're local jurisdiction. And even though we will cross state lines to work with other groups, I didn't want to be outdone by our neighbors way to the east there in Massachusetts, so I wanted to provide a perspective of where we're at and where our district is located. This is where we're located on the southern portion of the Panhandle about 200 miles, less than 200 miles from Denver, and about 800 miles from Minnesota. In the state of Nebraska, we have a wide variety and variability of resources. From where we're located in the southern panhandle, our precipitation ranges from 14 to 18 inches all the way to the southeast corner, about 34 to 36 inches of precipitation. Right in this corner here is the highest point of Nebraska. It's actually a mile high, and we'll get high peak climbers that will actually go there, drive their car up to it, so they can say that they attended scaled those heights. And so that's our high point, 5,280 feet above sea level, all the way to about 800. Our soils out here are silt to sandy. To the east, it's clay. We have out here short summers, but they're hot. So you see the wide variability. In Nebraska here, we have 23 NRDs. Again, they were named by the watershed, but what's interesting is that at least half of our district right here actually flows to the North Platte River. What are natural resources districts, or the acronym is NRDs? It's not to be confused with NERDs, but NRDs. And NRDs are multi-purpose local political subdivisions of the state. We're no different than the city government or a school board. Our board of directors, and in my case, I have seven directors. In NRD system, we can go from 5 to 21 board of directors. These are nominated and elected by sub-districts, so they are nominated governing body. I think that next year we are entering our 40th year, and I think we had some real visionaries back in 1972 or even a little bit earlier, that they consolidated about 140 various soil and water conservation districts, reclamation districts. We still have irrigation districts in the state, but I think that makes us unique that 40 years ago we started consolidating these various government entities. Also, something that's very unique is that we do apply a property tax. It's a very small amount, and our district is about 2.5% of your tax liability. Counties, schools, and the city governments make up the largest tax base. Our budget is about $2.6 million for a small district of 16,500 people. So it's a very rural area in all directions, if, you know, the 200 miles from the Denver or to Laramie or Cheyenne. Our responsibilities, and this is dictated through the NRD laws, a law that was established back in started in 1969, but the NRDs were formed in 1972. There's 12 laws that are outlined, from anywhere from ground and surface water management to drainage improvement and channel improvement. So this here was all consolidated in the early 1980s, at least in our district, because we're the high plains, very limited on any trees. Forestry, conservation tree planting was very big. That quickly shifted to groundwater responsibilities with water quality issues that came on in the 1980s. And so I'd like to focus a little bit on the groundwater and surface water management aspect of our responsibilities. And what water management was going on today? In our district, it's very much all groundwater. We have very limited surface water. The Lodgepole Creek that you saw there, it's historically has never been a complete, it's been intermittent over time with the development of irrigation in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The flow has diminished, but there's always been a spot within that flow, that creek, that was subsurface. And then we have a little bit of the corner there in Dole County with the South Platte River. So pretty much everything that we look at in our district is groundwater, comes from groundwater for domestic use, for irrigation, for agriculture, for municipal use, you know, et cetera. So groundwater is very important to this area, which is about 98% all private land. In about 1975, a few years after the legislature adopted the NRD law, they also did adopt what we call the Groundwater Management and Protection Act. And since 1975 up to today, that act has been modified a number of times. Groundwater quality is a very big responsibility for the NRDs throughout the state of Nebraska. We look not at point source here. The State Department of Environmental Quality is responsible for that. We're responsible of groundwater quality on a more regional basis. So if there's an individual that has a high nitrate in his well, it's not assuming that that individual is the cause of the problem. We look at through our monitoring, our observation network throughout, and base any kind of policy on that kind of information. Groundwater quality is unique to the natural resources districts. We have established district-wide groundwater management area rules and regulations. However, in both of these, the state can't intervene if the NRD does not participate. And as you'll find out in what was similar to other talks this afternoon, there's a real partnership with a variety of different groups, from Pheasant Forever to federal agencies like NRCS or USGS. And then third is fairly unique to Nebraska in that finally Nebraska just recently realized politically that surface and groundwater is pretty much interrelated. I'd like to, you know, mention that, you know, if you put a red dot of dye in a water source, it pretty much span out through the whole area in various levels of red and pinks and whatever. Physically, I think Nebraskans understood that, you know, if the well's next to the creek and they see the surface water decline, that there was a connection there. Politically, it wasn't until later in 2004 when the state realized that there was this interconnection. And this slide just to depict the board of directors, and we involve stakeholder groups in about everything we do. We have groundwater advisory groups in all three counties. We have variance advisory groups to help us work through some of the regulations that we have. And that's a very important part of the district. This here is a goal statement for the district based on legislation that was passed. This here actually took our integrated management planning work group about 4 or 5 months to develop. Our groups are a cross-section of all of our water users within the district, from municipalities to ag use, livestock industry, game and parks in Nebraska's game and parks representatives, Department of Natural Resources. The law actually states, and that's why we tried to simulate in some ways in our goal, is that we are required to sustain a balance between water uses and water supplies so that economic viability, social and environmental health, safety and welfare of the river basin, sub-basins or reaches can be achieved and maintained for the near or long-term basis. And the state, and this is one of the things that's with this integrated management, we are joined at the hip in this situation with the Department of Natural Resources in Nebraska. So this was approved by them as well as our board of directors. This here looks at the over-appropriated part of the integrated management area. And this area here is the Platte River Basin. This is the South Platte, the confluence a little bit west, east of North Platte, Nebraska. And this is our district right down in here. The blue is the over-appropriated area. The gray area is the fully appropriated, which in some ways is a sustained environment. Any additional development would put us over and over appropriated like we have in the blue. And we're in the process of working backwards to get to that fully appropriated level, and we're still working at that. A close-up of our three-county area and the distribution of our irrigation wells, it's really relative. We have only about 130,000 irrigated acres. To the north, to the NRD to the north of us, they have about 2,500 irrigation wells and substantially more irrigated ground. We have 130,000 irrigated acres and about 1,000 wells, but it's still relative in that later in some of the impacts that we've had with drought, we've had some real challenges. And so you'll see in the Lodgepole Creek area, the Sydney Draw area, here's Sydney. And all through here is the over-appropriate area that we're working to try to get back to fully appropriated. This is shallower to groundwater. And then we have the deeper depths here over the Ogallala. This here is a schematic or configuration of the water table of our district in yellow. You'll see the contours here pretty much go from west to east to the South Platte River here. However, this here is looking at the contours of the groundwater, and these are some of our aquifers, but the groundwater will move in a northeast direction of the North Platte River in this up here. We have basically three formations: the Brule Formation, which is pretty much a consolidated material, other than hundreds of thousands of years ago when it's exposed, there were fractures that were formed, and then those areas, which are basically around Sydney, into the western part of our district around Bushnell, where the fractures were formed, and that's an aquifer. It dewaters very rapidly in a drought, but it recharges very rapidly in large rain events. And then the yellow areas is the Ogallala Formation. It's a mixture of things that have come off the Rocky Mountains. It's not homogeneous by any means, so that presents a number of challenges for us. And it's 200, 250 feet to groundwater in that area, with depths of to the bedrock of about 600 feet up in northwestern part of Cheyenne County. This gives you a profile view of the three aquifers. The third aquifer is the alluvium, the material that washes down into the lower-lying areas overlying the Brule Formation. And this is typical of a hydrograph in the Brule Formation. This is from about 1975 to roughly the severe drought that we had in 2002. And you'll see over time with the current development that we have in our district, we're never really getting back to pre-development times, you might say. These areas here, you'll have your fall ratings, spring ratings, but in these areas here are significant droughts that took place. This drought here in 2002, from my understanding, was the most severe in about 300 years based on tree rings. It was pretty significant. At that time, we were probably in a range of 4 to 7 inches of precipitation. Nothing ever greened up out there. It was pretty severe. Domestic wells were going dry. Irrigation wells were pumping air. And then down here we have a typical hydrograph of alluvium wells and then the Ogallala wells, but we're still seeing a very gradual decline over time. This is a U.S. drought monitor that goes back to that 2002 year, and you can see we were on a very extreme drought, exceptional. And it really was, the grasshoppers and the threat of fire, and nothing turned green that year, anywhere from 4 to 7 inches of total rainfall that year across our district. This year, we're sort of in just a dry area, but you can see then down here in Texas where some of those fires are taken, they were in extreme drought. And, of course, the drought does not show any advanced note or doesn't let you know in advance that it's coming along. It's all of a sudden a real problem, and it's something that we have to deal with. I just jumped a little bit to groundwater quality, and we have that authority, and we have a couple sub-areas, and it's basically in our area, it's nitrate-nitrogen. The background nitrate-nitrogen in this area, on the tablelands or in the valley, is about 2 to 4 parts per million. Around the Sydney area, a little bit heavier irrigation than over in the Big Springs area. Anything that at one time was ranging up, upwards of, like 64 parts per million. EPA Safe Drinking Water Standard is 10 parts per million. And through our regulatory program, we have different triggering mechanisms, phase 1, 2, and 3, with management practices to try to bring that down. And we are seeing with our graphs trends that are going down on average that's looking very good. It's not only because of the management through our program, but it's additional with the rain, the cooperative effort with the producers. This schematic I think has always been intriguing to me, especially going through some of the droughts. I've been there 25 years, 2002. I never want to go through again. It's very significant, especially when you're dealing with just groundwater and trying to manage that. Here's a depiction of Lodgepole Creek and all the demands that are placed out there, even with a small populated area. Municipalities have certain requirements that they have to meet, golf courses. You have your environmental groups, producers that maybe want to expand, some of their irrigation and so forth. So, the system at some point it's going to snap, and I think we've seen that with 2002, and it's probably in some ways was a blessing because it really brought to a head the concerns that we were trying to promote earlier on in managing the groundwater and trying to sustain a balanced level. But even with the smaller population, there were some major impacts because of the development of groundwater. And so we look at our tools as we are regulatory in nature. We look at and we have established now a moratorium throughout the district as far as any new and or expanded uses, whether it's irrigation, municipalities, industry. We set baselines for, based on the law there, those baselines, if they're exceeded, they have to be offset. And so in order to have some economies here, we do allow transfers of water. We do pull water, working with the irrigators. And if we have some new users, it has to be offset some way. If an industry like a bottle industry or an ethanol plant wanted to come in, which would be a mistake anyway because of the amount of water that's needed, the industry would probably have to purchase an irrigation pivot to offset that new water use. And so we're involved in establishing banking mechanisms. So if somebody wants to come in, we'll have water set aside. You know, that can be purchased, possibly brokering some of this. We're moving down that road. But with our rules and regulations, if there's something that somebody wants that's contrary to our rules and regulations, they can always come through our variance advisory group, and it's made up of their own peers on a very local level. They'll come and present their position, where they're at. My staff will work with them on that. They come before the board or this variance advisory group, and they are only a group that makes recommendation. Their recommendation, whether positive or negative, will go to my board of directors, the governing body, to make the final decision. And of course, there's always, you know, lawsuits, civil action can be taken place against us if that's the case, if there is that, you know, if there's a problem there. And so that goes with, you know, many of you probably heard whiskey is for drinking and water's for fighting for by Mark Twain. And going through the last number of years in a drought that lasted in most of our district for almost 10 years, we did experience some lawsuits involving irrigation districts for basin-wide, the larger picture, that I didn't mention, but even though each district is unique in itself, we do cross political boundaries to work together on a regional basis. I forgot to mention that earlier. And then also with the city of Sydney in 2002, there was we had a lawsuit against with them in a small town. You can imagine some of the heartburn that took place at that time. And so shifting gears here a little bit, I want to mention, and this is the best part, I think, is turning it over to Jim and talking about the airborne geophysical mapping technology that we're looking at as a smaller district. The funding is becoming more of an issue. I'd just like to share with you here just real quickly with this technology, and Jim will explain it to you quite a bit better than I could. This is with airborne geophysical mapping. Here's Lodgepole Creek. We're showing the bedrock here because one of the tools, other tools that I didn't mention, is we're moving into that, and we have been in the mode of modeling efforts to try to simulate the environment where the groundwater is at the best we can, because it's very frustrating, you know, to try to manage groundwater. You know, we've been working with improving our groundwater management modeling. And this is a technique associated with regular drill boring that can really help with the modeling in defining the bedrock, you know, of our groundwater system, and to eventually maybe even determine the volume of water that we might have out there to better manage and implement management that will help address the decline of our groundwater. But just to go back and forth here, here's using the bowl, you know, interpretation of borehole on our geology there. But then with this new science, this best science that we have been working with since 2008, and actually earlier in early 2000, we were trying to look funding for this. But it wasn't until later when we had substantial funding that we're able to do some flight lines here in 2008, 2009, and we're continuing to move forward with a strong interest in pursuing this throughout our entire district. We've been to Washington, D.C. to talk to Ann Castle, the Assistant Secretary to Ken Salazar, on this kind of technology and the federal government becoming more and more involved as a partner in this. So with that, I want to thank you very much, and I want to turn this over to Jim, or the WOW part of the presentation.
Thanks, Rod. I hope that set the table for a little bit of comfort for everybody in the room. All day long, we've been talking about our water problems, and a lot of them, we diagnose our problems and we manage our problems through a system of models, whatever they may be. But what are models? They're a representation of the real world. And what I'd like to show you today is the ability to improve those representations and put them directly into groundwater models that improve the results of the model. This isn't done in a vacuum. It's done in cooperation with a lot of different people. It's important to know that this is a statewide effort, but locally administrated. And what I mean by that is we've been funded by the Environmental Trust, local NRDs, but not every NRD is part of this project. It's the NRDs that seem to be involved in that whiskeys for drinking and waters for fighting for. If you want interesting things to read about, pull out some of the water war legislation that's out there in the western part where I live and where Rod lives. We spend millions of dollars. The last lawsuit on the tributary where I live, which is the North Platte River, was with Wyoming, and it cost $22 million. The type of technology that I'm showing you today, we've spent about $2 million so far, gathering good information to put into models for good management decisions. So let's move right along. We have a big team. It's like the Wizard of Oz. It's this big team behind the curtain, but you're listening to me today. But I guarantee you, I cannot do this myself. Jared Abraham, who's a geophysicist, he can't do it himself. We can't do it without the local folks. So the important part is gather this team and work together to make things happen. Western Nebraska, a little bit different than Minnesota. Truly, this would be a normal landscape that you would see out in the western part of the state. Grass-covered prairies, very little trees except for the shelter belts that the NRD planted right here to protect the farm stands from wind. If you like wind, come out to western Nebraska. Guaranteed, you'll love it. The important part here is, and I'm going to move along because I want to show you the results, but this is what we're mapping is the geology. This is an outcrop of the Ogallala along Lodgepole Creek, and the water resources that are used in the state generally come from wells. There's 1 million acres that are irrigated with surface water, but there's 8 million acres of groundwater irrigation. There's 110,000 high-capacity wells in Nebraska. We're the number one irrigator in the United States. So we know what we're talking about when you talk about depletions and the amount of groundwater development. Our economy is based on groundwater for the most part. So what are we looking at for the geology? It may sound simple, but it's very complicated. When you start looking into the hydrostratigraphic units, this is something we put together for the Coheist groundwater model. We divided things up by hydrostratigraphy, which is a little different than standard stratigraphy, because groundwater models don't care if it's Pliocene sand and gravel or Eocene sand and gravel. It wants to know if those sand and gravels are connected without a barrier in between. So that's how we lump things together to make the mod flow models run a little bit better. We took this same concept, the reason it's important, we took the same concept and applied that to the airborne geophysics mapping that we're doing. So when you see a map, like in the lower right-hand corner here, this is Grand Island. This is about 300 miles. This is 30,000 square miles of the Coheist groundwater model that we put together. This is hydrostratigraphic unit number 2, which is the alluvium and Pliocene broadwater formation, another of alluvium, but older than the Quaternary. And we lumped it all together, and this is all based on boreholes, outcrops, surficial mapping. It's the traditional way to do hydrostratigraphy and hydrogeology. But what is one of the limitations? I have a borehole here, and then 2 miles away I have another one. And as good geologists, we interpolate in between. What if I could tell you, and I'm going to show you, that I can give you a virtual borehole every 9 feet to fill in between? It's a big deal. So how do we do this? We have multiple platforms that we've tested in Nebraska. We didn't just go and say, here's a contractor, and we're going to use this system, and it's going to be it for us. The USGS is about applying very good, well-thought-out science to your particular problem. We had very patient cooperators that allowed us the time to put this together. But it's rock-solid stuff that we have supplied them for their groundwater modeling effort. We have tested 5 different airborne platforms from frequency domain to time domain. I'm not going to get into all the gizmos and the technology there because, frankly, I'm a groundwater surface water geologist. I'm not a geophysicist, but I'm part of this team, and I know a good thing when I see it. Here's an example of the frequency domain system. It's from a company called Frugro. This machine right here sends and receives signals that it projects into the earth. And all it's mapping is the change in electrical resistivity that you can relate to the lithology in the ground. What's good about this is it flies at 70 miles an hour, and it's taken a sounding every 3 meters. And it's quick, it's fast, you don't need permission to get on somebody's farm, you need to let them know. I mean, they're going to want to know why a torpedo just flew over their house. And by the way, we don't fly over houses, and I don't want to diverge, but this is an important story. When we started this project, we did a great job with the NRDs, and they told everybody this was coming. And I got a phone call on a Saturday morning at 6 o'clock, and this lady says, my horses are out, and what are you going to do about it? And I said, I don't understand what you're talking about. I was barely awake. She goes, well, you're running this geophysical survey. Yes. Well, it must have flown over my house and scared my horses, and they ran through the fence, and you got to come get them. I said, ma'am, I can't help you. The machine's still in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming. It isn't here yet. So you get a lot of interesting conversations going on, but the important part is non-invasive, fast data collection, and it's calibrated to all the traditional work you already have. Test holes, surface maps, everything that's there, including water quality. Anything that will help you figure out the subsurface to see the unseen, this is what this technology can do for you. So as we look at these maps, keep in mind, red is resistive, sands and gravels. Blue is conductive. In our case, it's a brule formation, it's a tertiary, and there's a lot of clay-rich particles in it. But the important part is we have these electrical contrasts that we can map and feed back into what our geology looks like. And here's some examples of that. This is that broadwater that I was just talking about, very coarse sediments. You get rip-up class of the brule that are a foot and a half in size in this Pliocene alluvium. Very coarse, very resistive, approximately 200 ohm meters if you're a geophysicist. And then over here you get this very massive siltstone that can be fractured or solid. So where did we fly? This is the Nebraska Panhandle again. Down here is Rod's district, but we also flew the district where I live. I live up in here, which is the North Platte NRD. But it was a cooperative project between government agencies, and that's what made it effective. The important part here is we collected in 2008, I think we collected all of the lines and data, that's the lighter blue, in about 2 weeks. And then in 2009, about the same amount of time. So lots of kilometers of flight line in a short period of time. So what does it look like in the South Platte NRD? From that information, you can invert the data and get depth sections. And then it also displays the data in multicolors, and the colors are related to the resistivity that was mapped. So that's the gee whiz part that the geophysicists put together for us that work together as a team, and we tell them what those resistivities at depth mean. So the geologist is still very much involved. Here's a close-up of it. If you go from the Wyoming border down to Sydney, which is about right here, you can see there's an awful lot of blue at depth. That's the brule formation that's coming up that Rod had on his map. The greens are the Ogallala. The greens and yellows are mostly Ogallala. The Ogallala is the trash can of the Rocky Mountains. It collected everything that eroded off and landed there, and it's a mess. If you drill it, if you like glacial till, you'll love the Ogallala. Everything's in there, but it's real subtle. So the important part is we are mapping at depth, and we are seeing the brule, in this case, up to 300 feet or more. But when we get up into this part of the tableland, and I'll show you some information as we move on, we needed something stronger, more powerful, so we went to a different airborne tool. That has been seeing in excess of 800 feet and doing the similar type of mapping for us. So, new interpretations. What does this mean? Well, this is the section that you can see right here. It's for this flight line by Kimball. We're coming out of the Lodgepole Creek Valley. You can see it's kind of green. And when we start getting into the Ogallala, these are those escarpments that you saw in the first picture. But look at what happens. All of a sudden, the paleo channels of the Ogallala cut down and through here and come back up again to a Brule High. When I showed this to one of our young groundwater modelers out in the Panhandle, he looked at this and he says, well, that's really interesting. He goes, what's all this? I said, we're going to be able to subdivide the Ogallala and the alluvium and show you where the potential preferential flow paths are in the model. And he stalled and he goes, really? And I said, yeah. He goes, that's going to make my model invalid. That's the point. So I knew we had a winner for a modeler right there, because that's what I used to do, and I went to hydrogeologic frameworks for a reason. So the important part is, here's our new bedrock surface. I showed you what it looked like. It's very similar, isn't it? But it's more than just looking at this map and picking dots on it. We have a lot of good people working on this. They can give us confidence intervals on our picks based on comparisons to test holes through a very good, robust statistical program. We also have depths of investigation. So the groundwater modeler, when we get into this range right here, see how they go from black to red? The red means that we have less confidence in that pick because of the power of the system that was mapping the base of the aquifer. And so when he gets into this zone and his model says, I may need to do something different here, he has a reason to make that change. He can go back and say, I changed bedrock in this area because of the statistics that came in for this. So it's pretty important to look at this and understand what's happening. One of the things that has come on board is you add all these picks and you cover the additional distance. What does this cost? Everybody wants to know what it's cost. It's not cheap. But in aggregate, where you do the block flights, it's about $9 an acre for everything. So when you're in our neck of the woods and fertilizer this year cost $400 a ton per acre, that's not too bad. Most farmers understand that kind of concept. So this is an example of the types of picks. These are where the flight lines are. Each one of these picks is a new elevation for the base of bedrock. And what's important is now we have a very complicated system of paleo channels that we never knew existed, because when you have a great distance between your test holes and irrigation wells, you have no way to draw those. Now we have these virtual boreholes that allows us to do that. So what does the change in aquifer material look like? This is all of Rod's district here. And what it's showing is pinks is where bedrock gained in elevation, and blue is where it's decreased in elevation. And so basically it's moving the alluvial material around. And I'm moving real fast because I'm watching the clock. I want to get to glacial mapping. So the important part is we're going to go forward. We did more mapping in 2010. That's yet to come, but that is with the time domain. And the time domain is what we're going to start mapping the glacial areas with. But we did map the eastern 20% of Nebraska is an area that's covered in glacial till. And we did three test holes, and we have done similar work with similar system. And I kind of want to move along because we've got about 5 minutes, and this is the important part for you folks. This type of technology does work. We started with a grant in eastern Nebraska. We did our traditional test hole drilling, and then we did the airborne approach, and we did townships and compared what our test holes did, the already existing test holes, and evaluated the system. For each township, the airborne flight lines added 110,000 soundings, 110,000 virtual boreholes into a glacial area. That's a big deal. All of a sudden, you can start figuring some things out that you didn't know existed. We did Ashland, Firth, and Oakland. Oakland is where the heaviest till with the greatest amount of clay was. We had good results, but not as great a penetration because the electrical resistivity properties of that clay absorbed the signal. Firth is a medium till, and Ashland is a light till. I'm going to show you Firth because it's the middle of the road. We're seeing approximately 50 meters, 150 feet into the tills. And again, warm colors are resistive. The important part here is We were out drilling these test holes. That's these black lines that you see on here. These are the borings. And we completely missed this sand body right here. And this is the Nemaha River alluvium. So why is this important? Well, let's keep going. It's not going to work. I have a voxel model, and I'll just play it at the end of the PowerPoint. Every time I embed these, they never work. So sorry about that, but let's go forward. Here's the first block. The NRDs in the eastern part of the state looked at this, and they said, wow, here's a sand and gravel channel. Here's the Nemaha alluvium. Do you suppose they match up over here? And being a good geologist, you kind of look at that. You got these trends going. And I said, they might. Yeah, that seems reasonable. They went into their own pocket, their own taxing revenue, and they paid for the next study. So we flew another 2.5 townships, and no, they don't join together. The important point here is, if you're talking about groundwater-surface water relationships, if you really need to understand what your aquifers are doing, one of the things that came up, and it's important to the NRDs in Nebraska too, is what's my volume of groundwater? You can guess at it, or you can go out and do measurement, empirical measurements, and actually calculate a volume. So what happened here was, is all of a sudden this NRD, which is Lower Platte South NRD by Lincoln, they were talking with the Nemaha NRD about a management area here, and now all they have to look at is this little area here as a cooperative across government boundaries. So it's the power of the tool. It is effective. You can use it in glacial terrain. I'm going to show you something a little closer to home. This is from Bruce Smith, who's part of our team. He's out of Denver. He's been doing some work with the Canadian Geologic Survey on several of the different glacial till prairie potholes areas with geophysics. And just real quickly, I'm going to show you some stuff by Spiritwood. Spiritwood is a glacial terrain aquifer that's on the Canada border with North Dakota. And when they originally looked at it, this is their conceptual model. They figure there's a paleo channel in the glacial chill, and the river system comes down through here. And so they said, all right, how are we going to do it? On the U.S. side, they used seismic, and they did a good job. They managed to find these channels, okay? But for the cost of the seismic, they could have done a lot more airborne, which the Canadians did on the other side, and look at how that channel shows up. By the way, the Canadians are a little different than us. Blue is resistive to them. So if you're wondering how I can call this a paleo channel, well, that's the colors they chose. So when you look at this, you can see that this buried channel, which is a couple of hundred feet down in glacial till, they were able to map that quite well. So is there an application for Minnesota for this type of work? I'd say there is. And it's not a panacea, though. I've got to caution you. You have to use this with good thought, good deliberation when you go into using this. So, you know, give us some feedback, and I'm going to stop right there. So, because we're about out of time. So there you go. Oh, yes. Let's do that. Yeah, hang on. Let's see. Let's see if I can do that. Go ahead. Let me see if I can make it go. All right. This is what it's going to look like in three dimensions. Let's see here. Why am I not seeing the... What am I doing wrong? Let's see. Show video. I can do geology. I swear. There we go. So this shows you can calculate volumes. You put your water table into this. In this case, all these sands are saturated, except very near the surface. But you can put your water table into this, calculate your volume. You can look at your resistivity in ohm meters and compare that to grain size. And all of a sudden, you can start putting together some real calculations on the amount of porosity that might be there and the amount of groundwater in storage. We're also working real quickly on another tool, magnetic resonance sounding. It's a cooperative venture between Colorado School of Mines and Stanford and others. Magnetic resonance soundings is just about to pop out onto the scene. We've been working on it for 5 years. It's a direct measurement of free water from the land surface and from a borehole. And it will give us a conductivity, hydraulic conductivity value to map to these volumes. So for groundwater modeling, this hopefully will be the way of the future. With that, I'll stop.
right, and that concludes our conference this spring.